Chapter 8. Race and History. In history, a great volume is unrolled for our instruction, drawing the materials of future wisdom from the past errors and infirmities of mankind. It may, in the perversion, serve for a magazine, furnishing offensive and defensive weapons, and supplying the means of keeping alive or reviving dissensions and animosities, and adding fuel to civil fury. Edmund Burke. History is not destiny. Much of it consists of mistakes which need not be repeated and crimes which need not be tolerated again. As Burke suggested, history is mankind's painfully purchased experience, now available free or merely for the price of attention and reflection. History shows patterns, even if it does not provide formulas. Its facts are especially needed when dealing with racial beliefs and issues, where powerful emotions reign, and where prejudice and bias have often been the norm. If nothing else, history can help dissolve the provincialism of time and place and the hypocrisy of selective moral indignation. Both causal explanations and moral judgments can change when the emotionally compelling issues of the present are seen against the larger background of the history of similar events in other regions of the planet and in other regions of time. Yet, although the past can shed a powerful light on the present, what we seek in the past is also influenced by what we confront in the present. Each successive generation may have need of a different mixture of the many things available from the vast storehouse of history. Nevertheless, history cannot be simply the handmaiden of the present. Even to have contemporary relevance, history must have its own independence of the present, for the value and validity of history depend on its integrity as a record of what happened, not what we wish it happened, or what a theory would have us believe should have happened. When considering the history of race and culture, we must consider not only the broad patterns discernible and the complex interactions of that history, we must also consider the pitfalls and limitations of history itself. Patterns in history. A history which spans thousands of years, encompassing the rise and fall of empires and of peoples, makes it difficult, if not impossible, to believe in the permanent superiority of any race or culture. Equally, such a history, full of cultural diffusions, transfers, imitations, influences, and inspirations from one society to another, makes it hard to believe that all the different ways of meeting human needs are equally effective, when those involved have gone to such trouble to seek better ways of doing things from other lands and other peoples. When firearms have displaced bows and arrows over vast regions of the planet, when a numbering system originating in India has displaced all sorts of other numbering systems among all sorts of peoples on every continent, when printing and paper from China have likewise spread their dominion more widely, more irresistibly, and more permanently across the world than any of the greatest conquerors of all time, then cultural relativism seems less like a principle and more like a fetish, if not mere squeamishness. Certainly, the peoples of the world have borrowed extensively from each other's cultures over centuries and millennia. This began with the earliest known civilization, that of the Sumerians of the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, which diffused outward to surrounding peoples, as did the ancient civilizations of Egypt, the Indus Valley of India, and the Yellow River Valley in China. The a priori dogma that all cultures are equal ignores the plain fact that cultures do not present a static tableau of differences, but rather a dynamic process of competition. Cultures compete most obviously in warfare, for the outcomes of wars of conquest can determine what language the descendants of the combatants will speak for centuries to come, what concepts will organize their thoughts, and what values will shape their moral universe. At a minimum, cultures are more effective and less effective in military terms. Wars, however, are only one of the ways in which cultures compete. More continuously and more pervasively, they compete in the many practical ways in which cultures serve a spectrum of human purposes, from the growing of food to trying to understand the motions of the stars. Agricultural methods and astronomy are just two of the many features borrowed by one culture from another. Horsemanship, mathematics, art, science, philosophy, foods, and music are just some of the innumerable things which not only supplement but displace the features of one culture with those of another. Whatever the nature of cultural competition, whether it is warfare or international trade, scientific breakthroughs, or the spread of popular music, competition means winners and losers, not merely a static display of multicultural diversity, as tribal symbolism and multi-provincialism. Some may lament that colorful local fabrics and non-Western societies have been superseded by mass-produced cloth from the factories of Europe or the United States. They may regret seeing traditional local drinks replaced by carbonated sodas, or indigenous musical instruments put aside while people listen to American popular songs on Japanese-made portable radios. Those who deplore such things are also deploring the very process of cultural diffusion by which the human race has advanced for thousands of years. It would be contrary to all experience if there were no losses accompanying the gains. What is cheap and showy may attract a certain interest by its novelty, but competition is a process of trial and error, of sorting and weeding out. To demand that human beings be right on the first try in each individual decision is to demand that they not be human beings. Cultural competition has been an integral part of the history of racial and ethnic groups around the world. Emigrants have moved across mountains and oceans because what they had to offer was more valuable somewhere else than it was where they were born. It was not the material wealth that they brought with them, often pathetically small, which was crucial, but the cultural characteristics or human capital that enabled them to create new wealth for themselves and for the society around them at their many destinations. Unfortunately, one of the most recurrent patterns in history is that the passive beneficiaries of a growing prosperity created by foreigners have often been among the bitterest enemies of those foreigners who supplied the missing skills, organization, and other human capital that made it all possible. Where the creators of wealth receive, on average, somewhat more of it than the passive beneficiaries, the latter may feel that the former have benefited at their expense, exploiting them in some undefined way, rather than seeing that wealth creation is not a zero-sum game. Accusations of this sort have been hurled at the Chinese in Southeast Asia, the Indians in East Africa, and numerous other groups who have created whole new industries and higher standards of living for all in countries around the world. Such misconceptions about both history and economics have not been confined to the unlettered masses, but have often been prevalent among the intelligentsia as well. Indeed, intellectuals have often taken the lead in spreading such misconceptions and whipping up such resentments. Much as history has to contribute to understanding such social phenomena as wealth creation, history has itself become a target of desperate attack by those for whom the truth threatens devastating consequences to their visions, their egos, or their projects. A whole new class of intellectuals has arisen to supply a history geared to what people currently wish to believe, rather than to the record of the past. There are, of course, honest differences in the interpretation of history, but there are also dishonest differences. To allow those with a purely instrumental view of history to erase the national memory, or to record over it the ideological fashions of the day, is to discard an anchor in reality and to set sail with light ballast and a reckless optimism. Patterns in history do not mean that everything is the same, that nothing is unique in any way, but even to know how things are unique, they must first be compared. History offers more sweeping comparisons across far more varied circumstances than those of the contemporary world. History cannot be ignored because it will not be ignored. Contemporary controversies almost invariably engender passionate appeals to history, or to presumed history, or to the presumed effects of history. Years before the beginning of the Second World War, Winston Churchill noted how one man's warped view of history was producing in Nazi Germany currents of hatred so intense as to sear the souls of those who swim upon them. Misconceptions of history took a toll measured in millions of lives and in the devastation of a continent. Facts are the foundation of history, but an understanding of causation is the structure that rises on that foundation and for which that foundation was built. With all your getting, get understanding, was the biblical injunction that still strikes a chord after 2,000 years and in a secular society. Today, two contending ways of trying to understand history focus respectively on internal causation and external causation. Both must be understood, though current tendencies in the social sciences are to emphasize the external and ignore the internal or cultural characteristics of peoples, or even to condemn the very attention paid to internal characteristics. Many attempts to explain history or to explain contemporary events emphasize the circumstances surrounding a people, a generation, or a racial or ethnic group. The Marxian theory that economic circumstances shape the way people think and act is just one of these theories of external causation. Internal theories range from those which claim a genetic basis for group achievements to the theories of Max Weber, who argued that differing religious beliefs were a major factor in different economic performances by Protestant and Catholic societies. In the bitter disputes which turn on the roles of internal and external causation, those who suggest cultural or even demographic factors behind socioeconomic differences are accused of blaming the victim by those who see causation in terms of such immediate external factors as economic deprivation or social oppression. Since all of the factors cited on both sides can in fact be found in the contemporary world, as well as in history, a categorical victory for either side seems unlikely. The real question is, how much does the external environment explain, and which particular features of that environment? To say, for example, that peoples are to some extent creatures of their environment is to say only that genetic factors do not explain everything. It is hard to imagine who would have thought otherwise. Even those who believe in the importance of cultural patterns know that those cultures did not develop in a vacuum. The real question is, how is environment conceived? There is a vast difference between saying that people are the creatures of the society immediately around them and saying that groups with different cultural heritages react very differently to the same current environment and the same objective opportunities. Even the geographical environment can have radically different meanings. It is easy to understand how the availability of natural resources, including climate and fertile soil, as well as minerals, flora, and fauna, provides greater or lesser opportunities to peoples indigenous to different parts of the world. What may not be so obvious, and may nevertheless be of at least equal importance, is how the contours of the land and the presence or absence of navigable waterways have shaped or limited the cultural opportunities to develop the capabilities for dealing with the given endowment of natural resources. The caveman, after all, had all the natural resources available to the most technologically advanced societies today. History is full of the stories of poor societies with rich natural resources, which were developed only after foreigners gained control of those resources, whether through economic, political, or military means. In short, people whose skills and values have been shaped by different external factors in the past tend today to have different internal cultural patterns with which to confront the opportunities and challenges presented by the external conditions of the present. For example, Jewish and Italian immigrants arrived in the United States during the same era, equally destitute, and often lived in the same run-down and crowded neighborhoods, while their children sat side by side in the same schools. Yet they responded very differently to the educational system, including the availability of free higher education in New York City, and they rose up the socioeconomic ladder at different rates, through different occupational channels, and in different industries. Even those individual Jews and Italians who became wealthy and prominent typically did so in different ways. Nor was this pattern peculiar to the United States. The same differences could be seen between Jews and Italians in Australia or Argentina. That the Jews made clothing, while the Italians made wine, whether in the United States, Argentina, or Australia, can hardly be coincidental, especially since these same groups were prominent in these same industries in Europe before immigrating to these European offshoot societies. In short, different peoples have lived in different cultural universes, rooted in different histories, evolved from different imperatives. Understanding the nature and scope of the cultural universe is essential to understanding differences in the ways in which different peoples confront the same challenges and opportunities in the external world of the present. The cultural universe. Among the many ways in which cultures differ are their sheer size. They also differ, of course, in particular characteristics, and some of those characteristic differences have already been explored as regards particular racial and ethnic groups or particular nations. However, even for a given nation or given racial or ethnic groups, cultural changes over time have often been dramatic. In particular, the emergence of the modern way of thinking as a worldwide phenomenon, among the educated elites at least, has been a remarkable development of the 20th century. Three crucial aspects of the cultural universe will be explored here. 1. The effects of the size of the cultural universe on its development. 2. The role of natural and especially geographical factors in shaping cultures. And 3. The modern expansion of that universe to worldwide dimensions, at least as regards certain core scientific and logical processes and the technology flowing from them. The size of the cultural universe. The history of cultures suggests that population size matters greatly. Small, isolated groups of people have seldom, if ever, been in the vanguard of progress, technologically, intellectually, economically, or otherwise. This does not mean that population size is all-determining, otherwise China and India would be the leading nations of the contemporary world. But it does mean that severe limits face peoples who are both small and isolated from larger cultural developments elsewhere. Scientific breakthroughs have not come from small islands, whether in the South Pacific, the North Atlantic, the Caribbean, or the Indian Ocean. Where geography creates population islands on land, the Scottish Highlanders, the Montagnards of Vietnam, the Candian Sinhalese in Sri Lanka, or peoples who find only isolated patches of agriculturally viable land, as in parts of southern Italy or of sub-Saharan Africa, there have been conspicuous cultural lags behind others who were either in contact with more of their own people or with other cultures more accessible by rivers, harbors, or plains. Minorities living in linguistic or cultural islands, like the Volga Germans in Tsarist Russia or the Ulster Scots in Appalachia, may maintain the level of cultural development with which they began their isolated existence, but seldom keep pace with the further advance of their home country, or with the progress of compatriots living elsewhere as immigrants in touch with a wider world. It is not simply that encapsulated minorities are offshoot societies, for large offshoot societies such as the United States may surpass the scientific or other advances of the mother country. Rather, it is the cultural isolation of the encapsulated minority that is salient. Similarly, it is not merely raw population size alone that is crucial. A vast nation made up of isolated peasant communities may represent no very large cultural universe, when the peasants of one village have little or no contact with the peasants in a village 50 miles away. Mountains and highlands have been major factors in both cultural fragmentation and cultural retardation. As the eminent French historian Fernand Braudel put it, "The mountains are, as a rule, a world apart from civilizations, which are an urban and lowland achievement. Their history is to have none, to remain almost always on the fringe of the great waves of civilization, even the longest and most persistent, which may spread over great distances in the horizontal plane, but are powerless to move vertically when faced with an obstacle of a few hundred meters." However detrimental mountains and highlands may have been to the cultural development of those who lived in them, however much the upland may have persistently lagged behind the plain, in Braudel's words, nevertheless, mountains have had some positive cultural effects on those living below. Mountains are not only barriers to invaders, they also promote the continuous flow of rivers, because the melting of vast amounts of snow on mountain ranges feeds water into streams and rivers, making them less dependent on rainfall. Where there are no mountain ranges, as in tropical Africa, river flow varies radically between wet and dry seasons. Given the important role of navigable waterways, both economically and culturally, mountains are also important for helping to maintain the flow of those waterways. While geography and other factors have insulated some peoples from the cultural worlds of others, history has spread the Jews far and wide among many cultures and relocated them many times during the centuries of their wanderings as a people without a homeland. For no other group have cross-cultural experiences been more inescapable. The backwardness of isolated peoples has had as its counterpoint the remarkable historic achievements of the Jews, a relatively small group of people spread thinly around the world, and yet so prominent in so many countries and in so many fields that it hardly seems credible that there are fewer Jews in the entire world than there are Kazakhs or Sri Lankans. Historic differences within world Jewry only reinforce the general conclusion that cross-cultural experiences have been associated with cultural achievements. Where the Jews have been enabled or forced to maintain small separate communities in cultural backwaters, such as the villages of Eastern Europe or of Yemen, for example, there they have lagged far behind the achievements of other Jews exposed to the wider world of either Islamic or European civilization, such as the Jews in medieval Spain or modern Germany and the United States. The history of Sephardic Jews illustrates the same thesis in a different way. Once the elite of world Jewry during the centuries of their golden age in Spain, when they stood at the cultural crossroads of Islamic and European civilizations, the Sephardim, who migrated in large numbers into the Ottoman Empire after their expulsion from Spain in 1492, were initially very successful in their new settings. But as they lost their contacts with the rising civilization of Europe in later centuries, their initial prominence in the Ottoman Empire eroded away. By the time the modern state of Israel was formed, the Sephardic Jews who came there from North Africa and the Middle East lagged substantially behind the Ashkenazic Jews from Europe and the Western Hemisphere in income, occupation, education, and other common socioeconomic indicators. But this contrast within Israeli society did not correspond to any backwardness of Sephardic Jews in the lands of Western Europe or the Western Hemisphere, where they had suffered no such isolation. The cultural advantages of coastal peoples, as compared to their respective compatriots in the interior hinterlands, or of metropolitan peoples, as compared to their respective compatriots in the provinces, have long been noted by observers in many parts of the world. Words like provincial, tribal, or peasant carry connotations of backwardness, and correctly so, when they refer in fact to isolated groups. Even groups with special prominence in the development of world civilization have sometimes achieved that prominence only after emerging from cultural isolation, the Ashkenazic Jews of modern Europe after emerging into the post-ghetto era, the 18th century Scots, or the Japanese after their isolation from the outside world was ended in the 19th century. These examples add support to the more general thesis that the size of the cultural universe sets limits to the level of cultural achievement within it. Just as the extraordinary achievements of the Jews lend support to the thesis that the size of the cultural universe is fundamental to cultural progress, so this conclusion has grim implications for organized attempts to balkanize societies in the name of cultural identity, or of multiculturalism, as in late 20th century America, Britain, Canada, or Australia, for example. Quite aside from ideological hidden agendas behind these efforts, the organized, government-subsidized cultural fragmentation of a nation artificially recreates the effects of natural geographic barriers, which have constricted the cultural universe for so many peoples, with such tragic results in various parts of the world. This is not to claim that the opposite policy of government-imposed assimilation, such as Russification under the Tsars, has been widely successful. Both kinds of organized efforts and government policies have in practice made groups more culturally defensive and antagonistic toward one another. Where individuals and groups have been more free to retain as much of their own cultures as they saw fit, or to take from other cultures what they wished, the mutual absorption of cultural features has been considerable, and, more important, peaceful. Many of the benefits derived by the United States from its tens of millions of immigrants over the years have been due to its attraction as a place where people would be freer from religious, cultural, and other persecutions. Many came to preserve a way of life that, in fact, they or their descendants gradually abandoned as they became absorbed into an American culture in which their special contributions were now part of a larger mosaic. While the cultural universe sets limits to group achievements, individual achievements in some fields are far less dependent upon the cultural exposure of the groups from which leading individuals come. In writing, sports, politics, and entertainment, where the individual's talent counts for more, many individuals of national or even world stature come from groups not noted for scientific, economic, or technological achievements. An incisive writer like V.S. Naipaul, legendary athletes like Pele in Brazil or Willie Mays in the United States, or innumerable Irish writers, athletes, entertainers, and politicians in various countries around the world, exemplify such individual achievements. Indeed, groups less able to achieve in fields with large cultural prerequisites may channel more of their talents and energies into fields where purely individual abilities are decisively important. While there are also great individual feats in science, technology, or other fields of higher culture, so that Edison, Einstein, or Beethoven were not mere creatures of their environments, nevertheless, their genius required a major cultural foundation on which to build. In short, cultures differ not only in specific features or in their relative effectiveness for particular purposes, but also in their scope. Islam, for example, has provided a common cultural framework for interaction across vast regions of North Africa, the Middle East, the Indian subcontinent, and in lands as far away as Malaysia and Indonesia. Within this vast Islamic world, groups ranging in size from tribes to nation-states, differing in lifestyle from Saharan nomads to Malay farmers or Ottoman scholars, in race from Albanians to West African Negroes, have all been part of a cultural pattern which facilitated social interactions, ranging from trade to migrations to the building of empires. By contrast, the culture of Japan has remained largely confined to Japan. While Islamic as well as Christian nations have fought each other, it is also true that the wider hegemony made possible by a common cultural pattern can facilitate pacification among disparate groups otherwise likely to be at war, or at least withdrawn from contact with those whose cultural patterns are incomprehensible. Here, too, culture has practical consequences, in this case as an integrating force where diversity might otherwise exceed the bounds of the mutually tolerable. The Islamic culture provided a framework not only for Islamic peoples, but also for Christians and Jews living in the Ottoman Empire or in medieval Spain, for example. For administrative convenience, the Ottoman Empire agglomerated a number of Christian ethnic groups into an Orthodox community where they had a certain autonomy. Thus, the Christian Orthodox community was also a large cultural community, extending the Greek culture well beyond the Ottoman Greeks to Bulgarians, Albanians, and others encompassed by the Orthodox community, as recognized by the Ottoman authorities. This Greek cultural hegemony was shattered in the later declining phases of the Ottoman Empire, as ethnic minority intellectuals arose among the Orthodox to promote specifically Bulgarian, Albanian, etc. cultures within the predominantly Greek Orthodox community. In many other settings as well, a newly rising intellectual class has fragmented the cultural universe. Whether these were Latvians or Czechs rebelling against German cultural hegemony in the 19th century, or Maoris rebelling against British cultural hegemony in New Zealand, or the Aborigines in Australia, among many others in the 20th century. Language separatism, a bitter issue from Sri Lanka to Quebec, has been only one aspect of this fragmentation of the cultural universe. Among the forces operating powerfully in the opposite direction have been economic forces, more specifically, the international integration of economic activities. Airline flights spanning the globe require a common language in which pilots and control towers can communicate with one another, in circumstances where a misunderstanding can mean instant death to hundreds of passengers. It is less important that English has been chosen for that language than that some language be agreed upon and learned by all those with life and death responsibilities. In international commerce and finance as well, the stakes are very large when multi-billion dollar investments ride on mutual understandings. Here too, English has been chosen as a lingua franca, even when all those involved may be people whose native languages are not English. Intellectuals have often seen language issues, like other issues, in largely invidious terms, as implicit assertions of the superiority of English to Spanish or French, or of one people to another. But language, like other features of a culture, exists to accomplish some purpose, not merely to be symbolic or invidious. A more widely diffused language accomplishes its purpose more fully, regardless of the relative merits of various languages as such, or of the peoples among whom those languages have arisen. In the same way, a scientific or business ethos more widely diffused around the world facilitates international scientific and economic cooperation. Just as cultures are consequential rather than being merely symbolic, so the size of the cultural universe is consequential in itself, aside from the particular merits of the particular cultural features themselves. Geographical influences. While the influence of the geographical settings in which peoples evolve has been widely recognized to one degree or another, there is a great difference between saying that natural resources affect economic development and saying that navigable waterways affect the size of the cultural universe. The difference is between focusing on the external opportunities available to a given people and focusing on what cultural resources those people have within themselves as a result of the setting in which they have evolved. Geographical influences do not mean geographical determinism, for however much the contours of the land, its mineral wealth, the availability of navigable waterways, and the climatic and epidemiological environment may limit the options of people developing in a given geographical region, these people make choices within those limits, and the intrusions of the ideas, technologies, emigrants, or armies from other regions add to the complexity of the process and the uncertainty of the ultimate outcome. Nevertheless, geographical factors are among many other factors which virtually preclude equal economic and technological progress among peoples from the many and varied regions of the world, for the various continents and regions are by no means equally supplied with the factors that make for either economic progress or cultural integration. It is relatively easy to understand the historic implications of the vast deposits of petroleum in the Middle East, the iron ore deposits of Western Europe, the tin in Malaysia, or the gold in South Africa. What may not be so obvious, but of equal or greater importance, is the crucial importance of navigable waterways to transport these and other natural resources, and the products resulting from them, to different regions of the earth, creating wider cultural interactions in the process. The enormous importance of rivers and harbors to economic and cultural development is indicated by the fact that nearly all the world's great cities have developed on rivers or harbors. This reflects in part the vast differences in costs between transporting goods by water and transporting them by land. For example, in mid-19th century America, before the Transcontinental Railroad was built, San Francisco could be reached both faster and cheaper from a port in China than it could be reached overland from the banks of the Missouri. In the city of Tiflis, in the Caucasus, it was cheaper to import kerosene from Texas across 8,000 miles of water than to get it overland from Baku, less than 400 miles away. In Africa, even in the 20th century, the cost of shipping an automobile from Djibouti to Addis Ababa, 342 miles, has been estimated as being the same as the cost of shipping it from Detroit to Djibouti, 7,386 miles. Similarly, in 19th century Japan, before roads were improved and railroads built, it was said to cost as much to transport goods 50 miles overland within Japan as to transport them from Europe to Japan. Huge transportation costs shrink the economic universe, severely limiting how far given goods can be carried, and severely limiting which goods have sufficient value condensed into a small size and weight, gold or diamonds, for example, to be feasible to transport over land for substantial distances. These same high transportation costs shrink the cultural universe as well. The various continents and regions of the world are by no means equally supplied with rivers and harbors. Although Africa is more than twice the size of Europe, the African coastline is shorter than the European coastline, whose twists and turns produce harbors and inlets all around the continent, while the relatively smooth coastline of Africa offers far fewer places where ships can anchor in a harbor, sheltered from the rough waters of the open sea. Moreover, there are entire nations in Africa, Libya and South Africa, for example, without a single navigable river. This reflects in part the low and irregular rainfall over many parts of the continent, filling rivers and streams to a navigable depth only intermittently. Moreover, just as rainfall patterns limit the navigability of rivers with respect to time, so the many rapids and waterfalls of Africa limit the distances over which rivers can be navigated, even when they have sufficient water. Because many of Africa's rapids and waterfalls occur not far inland, even large rivers may provide no practicable access for large-scale commerce from the sea. The Zaire River, for example, is 2,900 miles long and has a volume of water second only to that of the Amazon, but it has rapids and waterfalls near the sea, thus preventing ocean-going ships from reaching one of the largest networks of navigable rivers in the world. Thus, the Zaire River and its tributaries are prevented from being the kinds of navigable waterways which have played so important a role in the development of other lands. Across Europe and Asia, and later the Western Hemisphere and Australia, man's dependence on waterways has been demonstrated again and again in the sites of leading cities, from London to Bombay and from Sydney to Rio de Janeiro. These ports become not only economic centers, but also cultural centers and centers of progress in general, as cities have led the progress of civilization. Africa's most famous civilization likewise arose, thousands of years ago, within a few miles on either side of its longest navigable river, the Nile. The two largest cities on the continent today, Cairo and Alexandria, are both on the Nile. However, a general lack of navigable waterways to facilitate economic and cultural interchanges has in Africa been reflected in a general dearth of large cities, on what remains the world's least urbanized continent. Except for the Nile, Africa's rivers that are even seasonally navigable tend to be concentrated in equatorial West Africa. Here too, larger, more advanced, and more enduring polities were established than in many other regions of the continent. The general importance of waterways may be suggested by the fact that, at the beginning of the 19th century, four-fifths of the world's population lived in coastlands. The modern development of artificially powered, non-waterborne transportation, motor vehicles, railroads, and airplanes, reduced that coastal concentration, but as late as 1975, two-thirds of the world's population still lived in coastal regions. In Africa, the coastal plain averages only 20 miles in width and is often backed by steep upsweeps of land which make road and rail construction difficult. as well as making Africa's rivers plunge over plateau edges. Geography is not all-determining, but it can set the limits of human possibilities narrowly or widely. For much of sub-Saharan Africa, it has set those limits narrowly. Not only were economic activities restricted by the high cost of transportation, more fundamentally, human interactions in general were narrowly circumscribed, resulting in such cultural barriers as numerous language differences and tribalism. Although Africans are less than 10% of the human race, their many languages are one-third of all the languages in the world, one index of their cultural fragmentation. The great number of languages and dialects in Africa, besides being a symptom of this cultural fragmentation, constitute as well a severe handicap in themselves, inhibiting effective economic or political consolidation of numerous separate peoples. Waterways extend the boundaries of cultural interchange, but in much of Africa they did not extend those cultural boundaries very far. For the peoples of sub-Saharan Africa, the most formidable barrier to cultural interchanges with the other peoples and cultures of the world was the Sahara Desert itself, which is larger than the continental United States. It was not until the second millennium of the Christian era that the central rainforest of Africa and the land south of it were much influenced by the civilizations which had arisen in other parts of the world. And until the 16th century, the influence of these civilizations was conveyed only through Islamic intermediaries. While the geographical influences that affect the cultural development of a people may attract less attention than such direct influences on economic development as mineral resources, land fertility, and the like, these latter are by no means always as decisive as they might seem. For example, an 18th century observer in Chile made an assessment that would apply to many other countries in other parts of the world. Here it never thunders nor hails. The country is laden with mines of all the known metals. The climate is benign, the fields fertile and irrigated. There are good ports and excellent fishing. All the plants and animals of Europe flourish. None have degenerated and some have improved. There are no beasts, no insects, no poisonous snakes, nor many of the plagues of other countries. In this privileged land beneath a benign and limpid sky, there should be a numerous population, a vast commerce, flourishing industry, and important arts. But instead, this most fertile kingdom in America is the most miserable. Conversely, Japan, virtually destitute of all natural resources, nevertheless became one of the leading industrial nations of the world, and its expatriates in Brazil dominated the growing of various agricultural produce in the southern region of that country. In Europe, likewise, Switzerland has become one of the most prosperous countries of the continent and the world, despite lacking almost all natural resources. If, as these and other examples might suggest, it is the skills and cultural patterns of a people which are crucial, then it becomes more understandable why a global redistribution of peoples, whether through emigration or conquest, should produce such dramatic economic changes as those following the Europeanization of the Western Hemisphere. Geographical settings which seem very favorable in presenting a spontaneous abundance of food, or lands and streams easily farmed and fished, may prove to be less favorable in the long run than natural settings in which people must develop in themselves discipline, work habits, and frugality merely in order to survive. Peoples whose cultures were shaped under the severe discipline of exacting geographical and climatic conditions have often been able to flourish when transplanted into more favorable settings and to surpass indigenous peoples whose cultures evolved under these favorable circumstances. People used to a struggle for survival in the less favored parts of southern China rose from poverty-stricken beginnings as coolie laborers in colonial Malaya to surpass the Malays, whose geographical lot in life was much more favorable in the sense of their ease of producing a livelihood. Much the same story could be told of the immigrants to Fiji from India, as well as other immigrant groups in other parts of the world. Something similar has happened when peoples from geographically less favored regions of the same country, Igbos from southern Nigeria or Tamils from northern Ceylon, flourished when artificially more favorable opportunities were presented by a new culture brought by conquerors and colonizers, cultural opportunities which their geographically more favored compatriots were not as quick to exploit. On a national scale, those European countries facing the turbulent and stormy North Atlantic, notably Britain, France, Spain, and Portugal, ultimately developed the technological skills and seagoing experience to become the world's leading naval powers in the modern age of exploration and imperialism. But those nations and empires whose naval forces developed earlier in the much calmer waters of the Mediterranean, where most sailing was in sight of land, never became naval powers able to challenge the upstarts of Western Europe on the high seas of the world. In short, neither on land or at sea are short-run advantages necessarily long-run advantages. Europe, Asia, and Africa have been the sources of the major cultural features of the modern world's population, not only because they contain such a large proportion of that population, but also because the cultures of much of the rest of the world, and especially of the Western Hemisphere, derive from cultures which first developed on these three continents. While geography has not by itself determined European, Asian, or African cultures, it has set limits within which each continent and region has worked out its own destiny, and those limits and these destinies have varied substantially between and within continents. On the great Eurasian landmass, where a majority of the human race has lived for most of recorded history, some of the geographical contrasts between the European and the Asian portions of this supercontinent have been as large as the racial or historical contrasts within these two regions. For example, Asia has suffered far more from floods, droughts, earthquakes, and famines than Europe has. Many of the great epidemic diseases which have struck sporadically in Europe have been endemic in Asia, which has been called an epicenter of viral outbreaks. Its diseases have spread through both animal and human populations, and crop diseases have likewise originated in Asia, where agriculture itself originated. Worm infestations have sapped the energy of humans in parts of China, India, and the Middle East. On the other hand, the soil of much of Asia has, on the whole, been more fertile than that of Europe, and has historically supported much larger population densities. The monsoons of East Asia and the hot summers accompanying them are favorable for producing rice, which supports more people on given land than does wheat, the principal cereal grown in Europe. Because the main population centers of Asia are farther south than those of Europe, even a relatively northern capital in Asia like Tokyo is farther south than Rome or Madrid, much less London and Paris. The Asian climates, combined with the ample rainfall, often permit two crops a year to be grown in much of the continent, compared to one crop per year in most of Europe. It is both unnecessary and impossible to determine the net advantages of the two regions of Eurasia. What is clear and important is that particular features of the natural environment vary enormously as between Europe and Asia, as they do within each continent as well. It would take an almost miraculous coincidence for all these factors to balance out in such a way as to cause the peoples of these two regions of the world to achieve similar technological, organizational, or economic levels continuously throughout history. Insofar as cultural development is influenced at all by the natural environment within which it takes place, nature becomes one of many influences, tending to make societies and groups within societies unequal in their achievements as of any given time. The geography of Europe is such that no place on the continent, outside of Russia, is more than 500 miles from the sea. By contrast, much of tropical Africa is farther than that from the nearest sea, and parts of it are more than 1,000 miles from the sea. Moreover, many African communities located closer to the sea as the crow flies are in reality less accessible to it than our European communities located a like distance from open waters. To be located 100 miles from the Mediterranean across the sands of the Sahara is not the same as being located 100 miles from the open sea in a river port on the Rhine or the Seine. In Africa, there are very few analogues to the Rhine or the Seine, or many other European rivers. Unlike much of South America or some other third world regions, much of sub-Saharan Africa lacks both objective geographical opportunities, such as fertile land and ample rainfall, and the geographical conditions favorable to developing the cultural patterns enabling people to make the most of whatever economic opportunities exist. To the difficulties of water transport in much of Africa must be added the devastating effects of the tsetse fly on animals and humans alike, making the use of animals in transportation or farming virtually impossible in many parts of the continent below the Sahara. While Europe's many navigable waterways made possible its long-distance transportation of common, bulky, and low-valued commodities such as grain to a greater extent than in Asia, so in sub-Saharan Africa, the unavailability of water or animal transport over substantial regions limited both the distance of trade and the range of commodities which were high enough in value to repay the expensive use of human carriers. Geographical features interact. Mountains affect the flow of rivers. Where there are large mountain ranges which collect vast amounts of snow, the melting of that snow feeds water into the streams and rivers, maintaining their flow even during periods of low rainfall. Put differently, in a vast region without mountain ranges, such as sub-Saharan Africa, river flow is entirely dependent on rainfall and varies drastically between wet and dry seasons. Land features affect water flow in yet another important way. A region of vast high plateaus, such as tropical Africa or Tibet, has streams and rivers that must descend large vertical distances on their way to the sea. This means that they must have steeper gradients en route than rivers which flow across coastal plains and are therefore less navigable or not navigable at all because of rapids and waterfalls. This in turn means that much cargo that is transported by waterways in other parts of the world must in such regions be transported by land or not transported at all. Land transport not only differs vastly from water transport in cost, but also imposes its own requirements. In the great desert regions, for example, the distances between sources of water, compared to the distance a camel can travel without water, determine which routes across the trackless sands or dry steppes are feasible and which are not. In turn, these routes and their traffic determine which of the oases have enough economic activity passing through them to become permanent settlements. Settlements at the crossroads of several routes through the desert, Samarkand in Central Asia, for example, could grow to be large cities, much as river and harbor ports grew into urban centers in other parts of the world. Even the political histories of the three continents were constrained by their natural environments. The great mounted hordes of conquerors who could sweep across the vast open reaches of Central Asia, the Middle East, and North Africa to establish their empires could not do so in heavily forested early Europe, where the barrier of trees and the absence of adequate grazing lands set a more formidable limit to these mounted warriors than the military defenses of the early Europeans themselves. In parts of Asia, the need for such huge communal projects as irrigated agriculture to take advantage of the monsoon rain patterns required a collective regimentation under political control. None of these broad geographical differences among continents implies that there is uniformity within a given continent. Even within a given country, such as China, the Yangtze River Basin receives twice as much rainfall annually as the basin of the Yellow River, whose shifting course and catastrophic floods have caused it to be called China's sorrow. The volume and depth of water in the Yangtze is such that a 10,000-ton ship can go hundreds of miles up the river from the sea, and smaller vessels another 1,000 miles beyond that. Meanwhile, Tibet has been largely cut off from the rest of the world by the mountains around it. Similarly, in Europe, where the course of the Gulf Stream as it heads north through the Atlantic produces warmer weather in the western portion of the continent than its similar latitudes on the east coast of North America, London has a milder winter than New York, though hundreds of miles farther north, the climatic effect of the Gulf Stream has less and less influence in areas more distant from it in the eastern portion of the continent, where rivers are frozen more days per year as one proceeds from west to east. Moreover, the meager rainfall in much of southern Europe has meant that rivers navigable by ocean-going vessels are much rarer there than in northern and western Europe. Parts of the Balkans, isolated by mountains and lacking river access to the sea, remained at third-world levels of development until late in history, when the technology of the rest of Europe was finally able to reach them. During the European industrialization of the 19th century, every one of the early industrial regions had the benefit of navigable waterways. Where that advantage was lacking, as in parts of Eastern Europe and Mediterranean Europe, and especially in the Balkans, economic development lagged far behind than in such countries as Britain, France, and Germany. The standard of living in the less favored parts of Europe was much more like the standards of living in non-European countries than like those in the more advanced parts of the continent. The fossil fuels which were largely lacking in southern Europe, for example, often could not be brought into the interior by water, the only economically feasible way of delivering them. Although urban growth was dramatic in 19th century Europe, few towns developed in the Balkans. As roads and railroads developed and were improved in the more developed parts of Europe, they remained virtually unknown in the Balkans, so that people living in Balkan villages were isolated from people in other villages less than 20 miles away. Before 1860, not a mile of railroad track was built south of the Sava and the Danube. The mountains along the Adriatic coast, marked by short and widely spaced river valleys, were yet another reason for human settlements to be separate from one another, and to have separate cultural development. In general, the Balkan mountains fractured the peninsula culturally, as well as isolating it economically, thereby contributing to the tribalistic divisions and lethal hatreds which have long characterized the Balkans. Although the Balkans were rich in natural harbors, there were few rivers to connect these harbors to the hinterlands, which were often cut off by mountains. While much of 19th century Europe not only grew economically but became interconnected with other nations within the continent and overseas, much of Eastern and Southeastern Europe remained self-sufficient, which is to say, isolated, poor, and backward. As people from Eastern and Southern Europe immigrated to the Western Hemisphere or to Australia, the backwardness of their regions became as apparent among them there as in Europe itself, when they began to compete for jobs with people from more fortunate parts of the continent, or with the descendants of such people. Whether in the Western Hemisphere or in Australia, Eastern Europeans and Southern Europeans tended to have to take the lowest level, lowest paid jobs, which were often the hardest, dirtiest, and sometimes most dangerous jobs. This is apparent not only in comparisons of emigrants from different nations, but also in comparisons between emigrants from culturally different regions of the same country, such as Northern and Southern Italians. Conditions in Southern Italy were in many ways similar to those in the Balkans, Spain, or the less fortunate parts of Eastern Europe, while Northern Italy, and especially the region of the Po River Valley, had geographical and industrial conditions much more like those of Northwestern Europe. It was not simply that peoples from different parts of Europe were richer or poorer. They differed more fundamentally in the extent to which they had the kinds of skills, experience, work habits, and general aptitude which developed in modern industrial and commercial societies, and which would be in demand in other modern industrial and commercial societies, such as the United States or Australia. These patterns were not simply a result of such subjective factors as other stereotypes, perceptions, or racism, but in fact reflected historical realities, however much additional penumbra of prejudice may have developed around these realities, or remained resistant to change after the realities themselves changed with the assimilation and rising skill levels of the newcomers. To say that the peoples of Mediterranean Europe have in modern times lagged behind the peoples of the northern and western parts of the continent is not to say that they are inherently less able races. For most of recorded history, the cultures of the people of Mediterranean Europe were clearly in advance of the cultural level in the rest of the continent. It is only within the past few centuries that their positions have been reversed. It was in Southeastern Europe that the great civilizations of ancient Greece and Rome arose, at a time when much of Europe to the north consisted of illiterate tribal societies. It was in the ancient Mediterranean countries that crops were first grown by Europeans, metals first smelted, and towns first built on the continent. Ancient Greece is estimated to have been 3,000 years ahead of Lapland in cultural development. While the navigable waterways of Mediterranean Europe were primarily coastal rather than rivers, these coastal waterways put Greeks, Romans, and other southern Europeans in touch with some of the most advanced civilizations of ancient and medieval times in the Middle East and in Asia. The fact that the northern and western parts of Europe had the key natural resources needed for an industrial revolution meant nothing at a time when human development in general was nowhere near the level required for an industrial revolution. What constitutes a natural resource depends on what human beings know how to use. Even highly fertile land was often not usable at a time when farm implements able to turn heavy soils were not yet available, so that intrinsically less fertile land was in fact more productive when it was light enough to be farmed with the implements of the times. Similarly, in ancient times, crops could be more readily grown on the hillsides of river valleys, where gravity automatically drained away excess water, at a time when human beings had not yet mastered the techniques of artificial drainage, whereas in later eras, the flat or gently rolling lands of the northwestern European plains became prime agricultural land, as did the land of southern China, after more advanced people from northern China moved down into that region and provided the drainage and other agricultural techniques needed to bring out its productivity. In Europe, the plains were often not only unproductive, but also deadly breeders of disease in the ages before they were drained, an arduous process which itself took a toll in sickness and death. For much earlier eras of human evolution, it has been suggested that Africa may have provided an optimal environment for the survival of the human species before that species reached a level of cultural development at which it could produce the kind of clothing and shelter necessary to survive in the colder climates of Europe and Asia, and then make use of the advantages of those continents. In short, what is a geographical advantage or disadvantage varies over time, and depends on the cultural development that has already taken place in a given geographical setting. One continent or region has not been permanently optimal for human development. Where the land in a given location will not permanently support human life, there cannot be permanent human settlements unless the produce of the land can be supplemented with the produce of the sea, as in some coastal regions of the Mediterranean. Otherwise, the exhaustion of a given land's productivity must be followed by a movement of people to some other land, at least until the first land has recovered its ability to sustain human life. Where the land is used for growing crops, slash-and-burn agriculture may be practiced, with the burnt vegetation serving as fertilizer for restoring the exhausted soil. Where the land is used for grazing animals, then it is the exhaustion of grasses and scrub which determines when the shepherds and their flocks must move on, or when particular kinds of animals must move on to be succeeded by other animals better able to subsist on the meager leavings. These joint movements of people and their animals may take the form of long-run movements of whole nomadic communities with their belongings, or the seasonal movements called transhumance, in which shepherds leave their families behind in permanent dwellings while they lead their animals away to distant pastures. The latter pattern is much more like the eking out of subsistence from both the land and the sea, only in this case combining herding and agriculture to make a living. But where such combinations are not available and the land will not permanently support human life, then permanent villages, towns, and cities are not possible, which is to say that the people in such geographical settings must forego not only the economic benefits of urban life, but also the cultural development which has historically accompanied urban development in countries around the world. More of their own human potential must remain undeveloped. Whatever the limits placed on cultural and economic development by geographical or other factors, it cannot be supposed that every group or every society reaches those limits. China, for example, sent ships on voyages of exploration that reached the east coast of Africa more than half a century before Columbus's historic voyage reached the Western Hemisphere. Yet China's voyages, longer than those of Columbus, and in a navy more advanced than those of contemporary Europe, did not lead to historic changes because China did not choose to establish colonies overseas, nor even to continue its explorations. China's cultural and political imperatives were simply different from those of European powers, so that it began an era of deliberate isolation from the rest of the world before Europe began its era of overseas expansion. A century later, Japan likewise chose the path of isolation, and in the 20th century, it chose the path of war, which ultimately led to its own cities and industries being devastated. The limits of a society's options do not determine what that society will choose to do within those limits. The modern world culture. Among the educated elites, at least, in various national cultures around the world, there is a certain vision of the world and a certain set of logical procedures for dealing with that world held more or less in common, and at the same time radically different in many respects from the visions, assumptions, and thought processes of people anywhere in the world more than a few centuries ago. The thought of human beings walking on the moon, for example, would have been staggering to most Europeans, Asians, or Africans 5 centuries ago. So would the microscopic world and its enormous range of effects on human health and life. Even something as mundane as a clock had sweeping ramifications, including not only a new precision in the concept of time and the emergence of the notion of punctuality, but also a new impetus to the development of all sorts of complex geared machinery which is now taken for granted throughout the modern world. The concept of our planet spinning on its axis and circling in an orbit around the sun is a concept that is now the common property of mankind, but just 4 centuries ago, not long in the history of the human race, men were burned at the stake for espousing such ideas. Much of what has become a world culture, or a set of beliefs and intellectual procedures superimposed on innumerable national and group cultures, originated in medieval and modern European civilization, though drawing upon concepts and products from other civilizations. By the end of the 20th century, these once peculiarly European concepts had become as familiar in Japan as in England or France, and the further elaboration and development of this world scientific and technological culture often came from non-Europeans, as well as from those who were the biological descendants of the people who first created this new mental vision and its physical products. Yet the world of scientific empiricism, now so much taken for granted by races and cultures all over the planet, would have been shocking everywhere in pre-modern times, not only because of its particular discoveries and products, but simply because of its way of looking at things. The development of this particular way of looking at things was a long and painful process, not just because of the intellectual or technological difficulties involved, but also because of fierce opposition from the learned and the ignorant alike, from the populace and the powerful. Learned men who refused to look through Galileo's telescope understood, or at least sensed, that what they might see were not merely the physical phenomena of astronomical bodies, but the end of the world as they knew it. While the modern era is often dated from the time of Columbus's first voyage to the Western Hemisphere, connecting two halves of the planet with one another, and ultimately making their physical and cultural resources available to all, perhaps the voyage of Magellan's ship around the world from 1519 to 1522 was an even more significant point from which to date the revolutions within the human mind that have produced the modern world. Not only did this voyage prove that the world was round, as it set out to do, but also proved more than it intended. When the ship returned to Spain, its log showed that the day was a Saturday, but when the crew went ashore, they discovered that it was Sunday. Scholars called in to explain this baffling discrepancy concluded that it indicated that the earth was spinning on its axis. The king ordered the log burned. He understood that the issue was not just about an isolated fact, but was a question of undermining part of the foundation under a whole superstructure of beliefs supporting existing institutions, societies, and ways of life. Copernicus, having determined that the earth was spinning on its axis even before Magellan's voyage, delayed publication of his work until he was on his deathbed, because he too understood the implications for the world, and for himself. Decades later, Giordano Bruno paid with his life for publicly supporting the ideas of Copernicus. European civilization was not unique in fearing the social implications of scientific advances. In the era of the great Chinese dynasties, astronomy was treated as a state secret. So too was a clock that the Chinese developed that was more advanced than any contemporary clock in the Western world, but which did not develop as far as Western clocks, which were publicly known and therefore had many people adding improvements to them over the years. Other Chinese inventions, porcelain, gunpowder, paper, and printing, were likewise more fully exploited in Europe than in China itself by European capitalists, who were freer of the kinds of social and political constraints faced by entrepreneurs in Chinese society. As in Europe, so in non-Western societies, many people's conceptions of the world had themselves in the center of it. What was common in the pre-modern era was not simply an ignorance of various scientific facts, but an absence of a canon of scientific empiricism, and the presence of a belief that ancient authorities and sacred texts were more reliable sources of information and understanding. In European civilization, the great authority of Aristotle's a priori conclusions about the physical world hobbled scientific empiricism for centuries. So did Galen's surmises about the human body, which not only antedated the dissection of cadavers, but served as a deterrent to such dissection. Copernicus, Galileo, Harvey, Darwin, and Einstein, among others, had to run a gauntlet of criticism and hostility for upsetting or destroying the familiar world inside people's minds. But once they succeeded in supplanting the old mental world with a new one, this new vision became that of educated people far beyond the confines of European civilization. At least a portion of every society became part of a worldwide culture. Race and culture were by no means always coextensive before, but they became progressively less so as the modern culture spread across the earth. Although the modern culture began in European society, it was initially as antithetical to the beliefs of that society as to any other. It was cosmopolitan also in its elements, in its mathematical foundations and a numbering system from India, in knowledge of optics and astronomy from the Mediterranean world, in the very paper on which this was written from China. To say that the modern vision or culture first developed in Europe is no more than to acknowledge its historical origins. To do so is not to be Eurocentric, but to be world-centric about a common culture of the modern era. The moral dimensions of history. Causation and morality are separate concerns, whether in history or in contemporary matters. What is most morally revolting or morally inspiring about a given situation may not be what is the most important causal factor. But while causation may be independent of morality, moral issues often cannot be independent of causation. Colonial Malay society was neither causally nor morally responsible for the fact that Chinese immigrants arrived destitute and illiterate and so took jobs which the Malays spurned. But generations later, when an independent Malaysia restricted the educational and occupational opportunities of the Chinese by law, that was a chosen policy for whose consequences the Malay government was both causally and morally responsible. Some seem to argue as if any historical or contemporary source of unhappiness which a government could have prevented is something for which it should be held morally accountable, regardless of whether the government or the society created the source of the unhappiness. This ignores the crucial fact that when the government has the resources to prevent in isolation or seriatim vastly exceeds what the government has the resources to prevent simultaneously. It ignores scarcity, the crucial and defining factor in economics. Given scarcity, innumerable sources of unhappiness that could be prevented should not be prevented, because to do so would require neglecting other and more urgent problems. Arguments may well be made in particular cases as to which are the most urgent problems, but that is very different from arguing moral culpability for a society which does not prevent every individually preventable evil. Misplaced specificity has plagued both moral and causal arguments. Seldom are either racial oppressions or the crimes of conquerors peculiarities of particular oppressors or particular conquerors. This in no way reduces the moral responsibility of oppressors or conquerors, but it does undermine the selective indignation of observers who condemn a particular society for evils common to societies around the world, and trace that evil to some unique characteristic of that society. To explain the enslavement of Africans by Europeans by things peculiar to Africans or Europeans is to ignore the obvious fact that slavery was a worldwide institution among the most disparate races and cultures going back untold thousands of years. The same approach which treats sins common to the human race as peculiarities of our society often also makes the fatal error of confusing victimhood with virtue by lining up on the side of the victim instead of lining up on the side of a moral principle. Yet nothing has been more common in history than for victims to become oppressors when they gain power, whether among the successor states of the Habsburg Empire and the Ottoman Empire after World War I, or among the successor states of the European overseas colonial empires in Asia and Africa after World War II. Misplaced specificity has likewise plagued attempts to understand the sources of many intergroup conflicts. The hatred and contempt often found in history between peoples of different skin color have been found as well between groups physically indistinguishable from one another, but deeply divided by religious bigotry or national animosities. To those caught up in racial hostility, skin color may indeed be crucial, but to an observer, historian, or analyst, such patterns of behavior may differ in no essential way from the behavior of those motivated by differences of creed, nationality, caste, or any of the other divisions of the human race. The oppressions, harassments, and humiliations visited on Jews in parts of the Middle East are all too similar to the treatment of the untouchables in India, or of blacks in the worst parts of the American South during the worst periods of American history. It is difficult to survey the history of racial or ethnic relations without being appalled by the inhumanity, brutality, and viciousness of it all. There is no more humane or moral wish than the wish that this could all be set right somehow, but there are no more futile or dangerous efforts than attempts to redress the wrongs of history. These wrongs are not to be denied. Wrongs, in fact, constitute a major part of history in countries around the world. But while the victims of these wrongs may live on forever as symbols, most have long ago died as flesh and blood human beings. So have their persecutors, who are as much beyond the reach of our vengeance as the victims are beyond our help. This may be frustrating and galling, but that is no justification for taking out those frustrations on living human beings, or for generating new strife by creating privileges for those who are contemporary reminders of historical guilt. After territorial irredentism has led nations to slaughter each other's people over land with virtually no value in itself, merely because it once belonged in a different political jurisdiction at a time before any living person's memory, what is to be expected from instilling the idea of social irredentism growing out of historical wrongs? What can any society hope to gain by having some babies in that society born into the world with a priori grievances against other babies born into that same society on the same day? The biological or cultural continuity of a people does not make guilt inheritable, nor can the particular economic and social consequences of particular past actions necessarily be isolated or quantified in the lives of contemporaries, not when innumerable other influences have intervened in the meantime. Moreover, no group was a tabula rasa to begin with. Yet a vast literature in many countries confidently attributes intergroup economic gaps or statistical disparities in occupational representation to particular historical evils, often with little or no examination of the specifics of history or of contemporary demographic, cultural, or other differences. In keeping with this approach, statistical theories of random events are often applied to group differences, not only in intellectual speculation, but also in courts of law, as if people were random events rather than members of groups with pronounced, enduring, and highly disparate cultural patterns. The integrity of history. For history to contribute to human understanding, its own integrity as history must be respected. A history that is essentially a projection into the past of current theories and assumptions cannot be a test of those theories and assumptions. A search of the past for group image enhancement cannot be called history either, nor can a record of the past, purged of whatever may be currently embarrassing, or whatever is vetoed by contemporary group spokesmen for whatever reason. Still less can a contemporary's presumption of speaking from the perceptions of others in the past be called history. The limitations of one's own perceptions are unavoidable, though much of value can be done within those limitations, through honest endeavor and competing interpretations. But the pretense of viewing history from someone else's perspective is only a conscripting of the dead for current ideological exploitation. To be a partisan of a subjugated people today is not to share the outlook of their ancestors who were conquered, and whose bitterness may have reflected disappointment at not being the ones able to subjugate and oppress their enemies. The idea that subjugation and oppression are wrong in and of themselves is unfortunately relatively new as a widespread belief. History as balm for wounded egos is likewise suspect. What was said of Irish-American immigrants during their difficult adjustment era in America could have been said of many groups in many countries. By 1916, Irish nationalism in America had little to do with Ireland. It was a hodgepodge of fine feeling and bad history with which the immigrants filled a cultural void. In the very different setting of Sri Lanka, both the Sinhalese majority and the Tamil minority have likewise created their own fictitious histories. The Sinhalese insist on their Aryan racial purity, Hitler's theories enjoying a vogue among them during the 1930s, despite archaeological and anthropological evidence to the contrary. The Tamils' history had Tamils discovering America centuries before Columbus, and a Tamil as one of the three wise men who journeyed to Bethlehem. In the United States, extravagant group myths have become a common part of the output of college ethnic studies programs. Even when there is an authentic history of former greatness, it may prove to be more of a hindrance than a help to current progress. No nation has had a longer history of cultural preeminence in the world than China. Yet this past glory has itself been one of the major obstacles to China's modernization. Back in the late 1890s, after suffering disastrous and humiliating military defeats from much smaller Japan, China continued to train its soldiers in such obsolete exercises as archery on horseback, and required them to pass promotions examinations which included quoting a classic work on war from the 4th century BC. The dramatic contrast between the prosperity of the overseas Chinese and the poverty of the Chinese in their native land may in part reflect the difference between people forced to compete in modern terms overseas and those long handicapped by a backward-looking culture, or more recently by ideological dogmatism, at home. The complacency of the Ottoman Empire toward the rising European civilization, which they had so often bested on the battlefield and in cultural realms as well, was an important factor in their ultimately falling behind the growing power of the Europeans, and then falling prey to them, politically, militarily, and culturally. Former greatness, even when real, is no magic key to future progress. It is easier to find historical examples of upstart nations which emerged from obscurity to move to the forefront of world civilization, Scotland and Japan, for example, than to find nations which recovered their lost greatness of centuries past. However much pragmatists may flatter themselves on their instrumental use of history, it is difficult to see how a mythical, glorious past can produce any more contemporary success than a real one. Such myths seem more likely to produce a romantic distraction from the hard, unglamorous work on which real achievements are built. Even the more modest claim that history should teach mutual respect for different cultures is suspect. There is much in the history of all peoples that does not deserve respect. How much, in which people's histories, is a very large question that no one can answer for others with different values. More fundamentally, respect is earned, not conferred. It is not a door prize. Equal respect is a contradiction in terms, since the very concept of respect implies an inequality of esteem and regard. All may be entitled to common decency, but not all can receive a higher relative ranking. For history to aim at mutual respect or equal regard is to prejudge facts and preempt other people's value judgments while prostituting the integrity of history itself. Much that is admirable may emerge from the histories of many peoples and the study of their cultures. But this can only be determined after the fact in specific instances. To impose blanket conclusions a priori is not history but dogmatism, and to impose them on others is not education but intimidation, violating the very mutual respect that is supposedly being promoted. History, like literature and law, has become a target of efforts to empty it of intrinsic meaning. While we all know from Einstein and from Marx before him that the position of the observer is an integral part of the data, neither of them said that it was the only part of the data, or that either science or history could be reduced to an exercise in solipsism or politics. Indeed, the very attempt to escape, evade, or delegitimize the record of the past is inadvertently a perverse tribute to the power of history, and to the great danger that history represents to any ideological house of cards. Conversely, to those seeking understanding rather than confirmation of preconceptions, history is of enormous value, and nowhere more so than in assessing heated contemporary claims and counterclaims involving race. Verbal abstractions. History requires generalizations about the British, the Japanese, or the Arabs, for example. For some purposes, and within some limits, this may be as harmless as it is inescapable. Yet historical generalizations have pitfalls over and above the pitfalls of generalizations about contemporaries. Across vast spans of time, the British refer to radically different people living under radically different circumstances. Above all, moral responsibility cannot attach to an intertemporal abstraction when deeds are done by flesh and blood people at particular times and places. The British were the world's leading slave traders in the 18th century, and the most implacable and relentless enemies of slave trading in the 19th and 20th centuries. These facts do not contradict each other or cancel each other, nor is it necessary to attempt a net balance for the British. Both facts are realities of history, and it is only our use of a single intertemporal abstraction called the British for a changing collection of people with changing ideas and commitments that makes the facts seem inconsistent. Much the same story could be told of the Muslims, who in medieval and early modern times often provided a haven for the Jews and played a major role in the intellectual development of the Jews during the same eras. Despite the seething hostility of much of the Islamic world toward the Jews in the 20th century, culminating in repeated attempts to destroy the State of Israel, Aboriginal peoples, both in the Western Hemisphere and in Australia, have been at some places and times targets of systematic extermination attempts, and at other periods of history have been subsidized and given legal privileges. Looking beyond deliberate policies to the wider social and cultural effects of one people on another, the picture is even more mixed, confused, or contradictory, especially if we insist on giving a literal, monolithic meaning to such intertemporal abstractions as the white man or the Asians. Statistical abstractions. The study of history has been enriched by a growing availability of statistics, including statistics on racial and ethnic groups, and by a growing sophistication in the analytical techniques and electronic equipment used to analyze these statistics. Like most human opportunities, like science itself, these opportunities can easily be misused to make matters worse rather than better, whether deliberately or inadvertently. Perhaps the greatest pitfall in the use of statistics is a failure to pay attention to the mundane but fundamental question as to how the particular numbers in question were generated in the first place. The more exciting and prestigious part of the work is the display of technical virtuosity in analysis and the derivation of conclusions with important intellectual or policy implications. Yet none of this has any validity unless the numbers themselves are valid for the purposes for which they are used. Many statistics which serve as the starting point for very sophisticated analyses are either inaccurate or ill-defined for the purposes for which they are used, or too often both. An example already discussed in Chapter 6 are the IQ scores of people of Chinese and Japanese ancestry. Obsolete tests, IQ norms decades out of date, and wholly unrepresentative populations used to establish norms generated IQ scores very different from what they turned out to be when these factors were finally recognized and corrected. In the meantime, a whole literature had been spawned by invalid statistics, uncritically accepted and used as a basis for speculative theories and sweeping policy recommendations. IQ statistics are by no means unique. Economic statistics, immigration statistics, and statistics on innumerable other social variables are subject to huge variations according to how they are defined, collected, and used. The number of Germans in Australia is 10 times greater by some definition of Germans than by other definitions. The same has been true of the number of Chinese in various countries in Southeast Asia, depending on whether persons of Chinese ancestry or Chinese citizenship are intended. And each of these criteria has further complications, depending on how one categorizes people of partial Chinese ancestry or dual citizenship, both of whom have been quite numerous in the region. Immigration statistics can be very treacherous, not only because of innumerable inaccuracies in the processes by which such statistics are generated, but also because of inherent difficulties in trying to use definitions which are relevant to the analysis at hand, and which at the same time will correspond to categories actually available from the official statistics. For example, if one counts all the people who immigrated from Russia as Russians, then many Germans, Poles, and other non-Russian peoples will be statistically transformed into Russians, and any conclusions derived from such statistics will be correspondingly invalid. For some countries and some periods of history, a majority of the emigrants from a given country were not members of the majority population in that country. Conversely, most of the Germans who immigrated to Canada in the 19th century did not come from Germany, but from Russia. Later, most of the Japanese who immigrated to Bolivia did not come from Japan, and most of the mainland Greeks who immigrated to Australia did not come from Greece. The economic fate of a particular immigrant group in a particular country is not always easy to determine, even in general terms, despite an abundance of statistics. In the United States, for example, Mexican Americans are either 1. Rising economically, like other immigrant groups before them, or 2. Are stagnating or retrogressing, depending on whether all Mexican Americans are lumped together statistically, or whether those who were born in the United States are distinguished from those who are still arriving and beginning at the bottom. The same is true of Black West Indians in the United States, who in the 1970 census data could be separated into those born in the U.S. and those who were not, while in the 1980 census all were lumped together. The fact that the 1980 data present a more grim picture of West Indians has been seized upon by some to deny conclusions based on the 1970 data, where the offspring of West Indian black immigrants surpassed white Americans in income. These and other pitfalls in statistics obviously do not mean that statistical data should not be used. Blind disbelief is as dangerous as uncritical acceptance. Both laymen and high-powered analysts must ask the same question: where and how did these numbers originate, and how are they defined? Sometimes, especially in controversies over public policy, the political origin as well as the statistical origin must be considered. In 1991, for example, much media attention was given to two statistical facts presented in tandem. 1. Black Americans received much less prenatal care than white Americans, and 2. Black Americans had much higher infant mortality rates than white Americans. The conclusion, widely drawn, and in fact actively promoted by organizations seeking a larger government funding of prenatal care, was that one of these facts was the cause of the other. Statistics in the very same study, however, showed that Mexican Americans received even less prenatal care than blacks, and had infant mortality rates no higher than those of whites. The invalid inference that lack of prenatal care caused higher infant mortality was an example of what might be called aha statistics. Starting with a certain presupposition, one may say aha when encountering statistics consonant with that presupposition. Often, however, one could just as easily have started with the opposite presupposition and found occasion to say aha from the same set of data. If statistics are to be used to produce a deeper understanding of history, rather than to support presuppositions, then the dull and tedious task of scrutinizing definitions and analyzing the processes by which numbers are generated must be performed as thoroughly as the more interesting and rewarding task of applying high-powered statistical techniques. Independence and integrity. The difficulties of maintaining the integrity of history as an independent record of the past is no proof that it cannot be done, nor an excuse for abandoning the effort, much less for condoning the substitution of other goals. Perfection in this is no more likely than perfection in any other human endeavor, but neither has perfection been necessary in other endeavors. Even a particular historical survey may achieve a certain independence of its author, much as children eventually become independent of their parents. Others may find different lessons in that history or see things that never occurred to the author. Certainly, the application of whatever insights history provides will vary with time and place. Ultimately, however, the whole point of history is not immediate practical application, but understanding. History cannot solve today's problems, but it can expose fallacies which make matters worse, or which make resolutions harder to see or to achieve. Above all, history offers understanding, not in the psychological sense of maudlin patronage, but in the sense of a clear-sighted view of reality, its limitations, and its possibilities. Nowhere is such understanding more important than among peoples from different racial, ethnic, or cultural backgrounds.